Okay, so just to introduce ourselves, I'm Roger Hallam, co-founder of Extinction Rebellion. We're sitting here today in this nice garden to talk about some major issues, let's put it like that. And yeah, Tim, do you want to say?
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm Tim Crosland. I work with a charity called Plan B that holds the government to account for its climate inaction.
Great. Right, well, we've had quite a few conversations, haven't we? And yeah, we've both been thinking along similar lines, I think, along with quite a lot of other people, about the climate crisis and how it sort of fits into ideas of right and wrong, ideas of legality, ideas of revolution. And I think what we're going to do is, in our slightly imperfect way, is investigate some of these themes. And I suppose, just to introduce it to everyone, there's this tradition about social contracts, rights, the right of revolution, and what have you. And it's very different from the modern tradition of, or this postmodernist tradition of, just do what you want, you know, do a little bit of activism, don't do a little bit of activism. And it's also very different from the sort of hard, let's destroy everything, you know, just because we want to, without any sort of idea, you know, sort of hateful, sort of destructive sort of thing, without any idea of any moral basis or any legal basis. So obviously I've been an organic farmer for 20 years, but I've always been really interested in politics and political theory and revolutionary ideas and philosophical ideas. And I've just done, well, I'm still technically doing research at King's College on civil disobedience. And that involves the moral and political basis of breaking the law and what have you. And then I've been involved, you know, I've been arrested 15 times and what have you in this city in London here. So I've got quite an understanding of the court system and, you know, how these things work. And I'm really interested in making clear that we've got right on our side. You know, I mean, we know that instinctively because the climate's so beyond fact, but it's like we need to have something a bit deeper than that, and that's what we're going to talk about. So what I want you to do is just say a little bit about Plan B and your background, and then we'll get on to the subject.
Yeah, sure. So I've always been interested in this as well, and this relationship between law and morality. And I actually remember the first thing I ever found interesting at school, because most of it I didn't find interesting at all, was when we looked at the play Antigone. It's a Greek tragedy, and it's actually about exactly this, where Antigone is told by the king of Thebes, "You can't give your brother a proper burial, and that is now the law." And Antigone defies that and says there are higher laws, there are things more important. And I was just, you know, I remember being really struck by that idea. And Creon, the king, ends up putting her, he sentences her to death. And the result is that his son, who's in love with Antigone, kills himself and all the rest. And the state unravels as a result of this breach of the higher law. So I've always found that interesting. My background is international human rights law and environmental law. At one point, I responded to an advert for the police to go and teach them human rights law, which was an interesting experience and kind of gets you seeing how things really
Well, you've been in the government, haven't you, for a
So,
while?
yeah, that's right.
Just to get that out in the open.
So that's part of it. You know, that's part of saying, well, where is power that sets the law? Is this really moral? And then having concluded that it wasn't, and the end of that experiment, I end up going to Paris for the UN conference on climate change, and I'm invited to support the historically low-emitting countries, the low-consuming countries of the global south, in the negotiations, because a lot of the small countries there, they don't have big teams of lawyers. They don't have people with a background in this. So that was the idea. And people know some of the story of Paris, or people interested in this area. They know governments agreed to limit warming to 1.5 and well below 2, but it's not really enforceable. They forgot about that bit. But there's a story that people, I think, didn't get to hear. It didn't really emerge about what was going on inside those negotiations. The countries of the global south wanted the 1.5 limit because research from Potsdam University had said if we don't keep to that, you're going under. Small island states just won't exist anymore. The US and others knew that's what those countries wanted. They said, well, we'll give you that on this condition. You sign away your rights to bring legal action against us. You sign away your rights to compensation. In other words, a completely dishonest bit of blackmail. You can look good in front of your electorates as long as it doesn't have any real teeth. That's what was going on. And so part of my role and the role of others there was to withstand that. And actually, countries refused to agree to that and won the game of poker. And Plan B was really born out of that experience. And the mission was, right, you governments who are coming back and telling your people, you've agreed this historic deal to keep us all safe. Well, we're going to hold you to account for that. We're going to show that that means something, that it's not empty words. And so that has been the mission of Plan B, to do that.
So Plan B is like a, let me get this right, it's like a legal charity. Is that right? Is that the right word?
It is.
And you've done quite a lot of work around holding the government to account, right? Is that
yes.
how you see it?
So this is, we're on to our third legal action now, yeah.
All right, so let's get going on the heart of what we're trying to discuss here then is we're going to look at this tradition, and on one level it's like quite historical and abstract, but I think the reason I wanted to make this video is the more you think about it, more sort of, it's more like dynamite. This is what we're talking about today, is dynamite as far as I'm concerned. And I want to say, like, it's ultra serious as far as I can see. You know, we're going to be talking about the most serious matters, the most serious legal matters, the most serious moral matters. And also, as we've just sort of said, we're beginning this conversation, aren't we? I'm not quite sure whether we're going to get it right. I'm pretty sure we're not going to get it right. So we're making this video in order to provoke more debate and discussion with lots of different groups to try and come to some new understanding of what it is to be a human being, a citizen, a moral person at this moment in history. So it's dramatic stuff. There's no other word of putting it. So I'll introduce sort of a certain sort of story here. And the story goes, you know, there's different ways of doing this. And it sort of, I guess, goes back to Magna Carta. You know, the idea that the king is not there to do whatever he wants. That's broadly, I think, what the Magna Carta does, and it has a big symbolic and maybe legal sort of status in British history. But I want to focus more like on the English Civil War, because for me, that was the point where it became real, which was, you know, Charles I was basically saying, the divine right of kings, I can do whatever I like. I'm above all the rest of you, metaphysically, spiritually, politically, materially. And if I want to go around and pillage and rape and kill, I will do it because God's given me that absolute right. And the English Civil War, my understanding of the English Civil War is, there was a war to say, no, you don't. You know, there's the law. And sure, you have rights as king, you have rights as ruler, but you don't have absolute rights. Basically, the law is king, as you might say. And in other words, there's a contractual relationship. So then we get this idea of the social contract, which is, you know, the ruler, broadly speaking, or the government, in a more modern sense, has a responsibility. Its first responsibility is to protect the citizens, to protect the people in that country. And what that specifically means, one way of looking at it, is the lives, like not to have people die, and their livelihoods. not to destroy their workmanship, their property, what they have, what they produce. And that was a massively radical idea. And I think what we're going to argue is it's still a massively radical idea, because we haven't exactly got there. And then that sort of moves on into the modern period, I suppose, in two ways. I think it comes into the idea of equality, that people can't have real rights unless they have social equality. So it goes into that sort of left-wing tradition. But it also is in a sort of deep liberal tradition of saying people have human rights, they have rights to family, they have rights to their livelihood, etc. And that comes into sort of what the UN has done. So we've got this lineage of ideas. But what I think is interesting is two things that make it more dynamite-like. Because I think with human rights, it's a little bit, it feels a bit sort of wishy-washy or abstract or liberal or something. But what John Locke was saying, who's one of the main philosophers behind this, was if the government plans or enacts the destruction of the lives and livelihoods of citizens, then it constitutes a tyranny. And if it constitutes a tyranny, then you have what he calls the right of revolution. And that's a bombshell. I mean, when I first read it, I thought, oh my God, you know, you know, this revolution idea is not some, you know, it's there at the heart of the sort of Anglo-Saxon, you know, political tradition. And I think, see, if you can look it up on Wikipedia, it's got these US constitutions with it. And the basic idea is, if a government oversteps that line, that's it. The government's illegitimate, right? And then you've got this extra sort of bombshell idea, which you haven't just got the right in the French Revolution, they say the sacred right and the indispensable duty to rebel and bring down the government. So it's not like, it's not like a thing you do it if you want to. It's actually, if you're a citizen, if you're a member of this contractual arrangement, you get protected. And when you're not protected, you don't just complain about it. You actually go out and bring down the government to create a true government, as you might say, which is going to fulfill its legal obligations to protect the people. So it's not, doesn't take an enormous amount to work out that what's happening now with the plan to destroy the planet, not to put too fine a point on it, which means the death and destruction of millions of people's lives and livelihoods, then we've got an interesting situation, haven't we? So maybe you can expand on that in terms, I mean, I'm coming from it from a political viewpoint, so maybe you can fill in the gaps a little bit on the sort of legal implications of this.
Yes, I mean, I just want to sum up that last bit because I think it is just the logical consequence, this idea of the duty to revolution. Because if you've got a state that is essentially treasonous, well, either you're complicit in it or you do something about it. It does become a binary choice.
Yeah.
So it can't simply be a right. It's a duty. Because if you don't act on your duty, you're through your inertia, you are part of propping up.
So there's a little sense there in, if you want rights, you don't just have rights, you also have duties. Like the two things go together. In fact, you know, in a sense, it's this right that the essence of citizenship, the essence of not just being a slave or a subject, is you have rights, but you also have duties. Like if you're a slave, you have no duties and no rights, you know, technically speaking. So this is interesting, isn't it?
It's really important that the reason duties are the counterpart of rights is because it expresses a relation to the greater whole. So this is the deal, isn't it?
Yeah.
The deal is we will work together and subject ourselves to various limitations on our freedoms. And the basic conditions is we all work within a framework where we agree not to do certain things to each other. And we agree to support the sustainability and the survival of the collective, the rights and the obligations. It's two parts of the same thing. Just going back to this idea, you mentioned a little bit earlier how we've come to associate the idea of human rights sometimes with a, you know, particular sort of political narrative. really all we mean by rights fundamentally is constraint on tyrannical power. This is how the concept of rights emerges. And you mentioned the Magna Carta, and this is when you have an unpopular King John, and the barons say, we don't want to be just arrested just because you don't like us. We don't agree to that deal. And the Magna Carta then brings in Magna Carta Libertatum, the Great Charter of Freedoms, certain constraints on that power. And then we move into, the English Civil War, and then the US, the American Revolution, and the French Revolution. And this, propels that narrative to a much more visible stage. Actually, all those things, it's the same idea at its heart. Rebellion against unconstrained abuse of power, rebellion against tyranny. So that's the idea at the heart of the English Civil War. That's there in the US Revolution, where Americans are rebelling against the English monarchy, against colonial rule, against the aristocracy. And so alongside the Revolution and alongside the US Constitution, you get the Bill of Rights. And the key principle in the Bill of Rights is, down with the aristocracy, because all people are created equal. And this is, a radical idea. And, we get the same in the French Revolution. And you see it in those terms. You start to see that the real issue that we have, and, the irony is there in the US Constitution, is that idea hasn't really been fulfilled. Because unless you properly deliver on equality and rights for everybody, then nobody's rights are safe.
Yeah, so how's this, as a lawyer, lawyers don't tend to talk about right of revolution. They haven't been doing that for a few hundred years, let's put it like that. But how have you you've just written a letter to the government, which says treasonous betrayal of the British people over, as I understand it, like adapting the government having the idea that it's going to adapt to a 4-degree world, which, if people don't know, has been shown to make whole continents uninhabitable. So say a little bit about how you approach this in a modern legal context.
So just to bring us right back to the here and now, and the present moment, we've got three things, haven't we? We've still got the scientists telling us we need an urgent and radical transformation now. We've had that for some time, for decades. We've also got the evidence of polls, of citizens' assemblies in France and the UK, telling us that ordinary people now want a transformation of the economy so that it prioritises health and well-being for ordinary people, so that our politicians have no excuse that they don't have a democratic mandate. And then because of COVID, we've got this extraordinary moment where there's political recognition, even from neoliberal governments, that we need a massive financial stimulus. So you put those three things together, there is actually an opportunity to do something we're not going to have again, realistically. All the advice going to the government, whether it's scientific advice, whether it's economic advice, is you must use this moment, both to prepare us for the crises we know are coming and to transition our economy onto a more sustainable basis. And what we're seeing is that our governments are abandoning the interests of their people. They're not listening to what people are saying. They're not listening to what scientists are saying. They're not listening to what economists are saying. The only people they're listening to are their corporate sponsors. And we know what the consequence of that is going to be. It's not just going to be tragic and miserable consequences for some people. On this trajectory towards 4 degrees, it's the dissolution of the state itself. It's this.
So how does that, you're making a moral point here, aren't you? How does that translate into legal argument, as it were? How does that translate into this letter that you've written to the government? From a legal point of view?
So we'll get to that in just 1 minute, but I think it is important to make this distinction between ordinary crimes and treason.
Right.
So imagine, you know, what do we think of normally as criminality? Let's take at the high end, you know, murder, serial sex offences, serial robbery. Imagine our government in the midst of a series of violent crimes just did nothing. Just said, we're not going to bother investigating these crimes. Just going to leave it alone, and actually started to give a platform to the suspects. Well, that would cause a revolution. People wouldn't accept that. They wouldn't tolerate it, because this is the most basic thing. The government must protect you from harm. But treason is that criminality on another level, because however terrible the consequences are of individual crimes, they generally don't threaten the survival of the state itself. They threaten some people. What we know we're facing now, not according to me and you, but according to consensus science, is a threat to the very existence of the state. The government itself describes this as an existential threat. It knows this is a threat to the state, and yet it is choosing the path that leads in that direction. It is choosing the destruction of the state. And so from a legal perspective, we say that cannot be legal to take the path that destroys the legal system itself.
We've got a legal definition of treason here, which is the willful destruction of the state, which translates into the effective destruction of a society, like massive social breakdown. That's concretely what we're looking at here. That's what the destruction of the state means. Is that right?
So I should distinguish between two things. There's the political idea of treason, and then there's the way it gets concretized into law.
Right.
And so in national law, you have the same issue with treason that maybe you have with terrorism, where the challenge is, how do we define this in a way that doesn't capture our own violence? How do we define terrorism so that it doesn't include killing hundreds of thousands of people in Iraq or Afghanistan? So it becomes something that actually strips some of that real idea away. So in our own law that dates to the 14th century, it's the 1352 Act, the Treason Act, it focuses on the king, the queen, himself, herself, rather than the state. And so to take that to an absurd example, you then have in Sweden in 2001, a group of young people tried for treason because they throw cream cakes at the king. So right. Not exactly a real threat to the state. But then going back to the Civil War, well, King Charles I, before he's executed, he's tried. And he's tried for treason. And the court says, well, we don't mean literally the person of the state. When we refer to the king, we mean the symbol of the state.
Right.
And the individual human being is there just occupying it, but must do so within the law. And it's on that basis that Charles is found guilty. So although our law doesn't, in fact, define treason as a threat to the state, it's about assaults and the enemies of the king. If you take that at the abstract level, that the court found in the trial of King Charles I, well, then it equally applies to actions that are threatening the state itself. And I mean, this is maybe not completely serious, but also you imagine this literally. Well, King Charles comes in at some point and yeah. says, these are, well, there you have this blurring of the literal. And
so you've got this move from the king being the manifestation of the state and therefore never being able to be a traitor. So you get this complete shift that the king himself can be the traitor because he's violating the very state itself through his, you know, insistence on absolute rule, as you might say.
Exactly.
Is that right? So this is the big shift, isn't it?
So this trial, you could say, this trial is also the seed of our political system.
Yeah.
Because it's saying, no, we don't have a system based on the divine right of kings.
Yeah.
We have a system based on principles and social contract. And, you know, this is the foundational moment of our democracy. It's not tyranny. It's not absolute power. That's why this court judgment is so crucial. Yeah. And we're back here again now. because it's just as obvious, isn't it?
Because we've got the proposition by the corporate elite that they can destroy our society without consequence, right? And, one argument, I suppose, is that the state has been occupied by that tyrannous elite, and the tyranny is defined as the willingness and desire to destroy the state and thereby the society, and therefore the government is involved in a tyrannous project. Is that right?
That's exactly what is happening. I mean, right. We can see that is what is happening. this is a project that leads to the destruction of the state.
Right. So without beating around the bush, the government are traitors.
Yes. I think
politically and also legally.
Yes, I think there is debate about whether the king... Well, we're not bringing a legal action for treason. Let's just be clear about that.
Right.
The legal action is on the failure to take account of the government's legal responsibilities to follow its own Climate Change Act.
Right.
To follow its own policy commitment to the Paris Agreement, but also critically, and this is where we link back to the argument, to do what's necessary to safeguard our rights to life, our rights to family life, and it's breaching the prohibition against discrimination in the enjoyment of those rights. Because we know that racially marginalised groups, the Global South, they're going to be in the front line of that. But what that reveals, the people who are dying now, the people who are being displaced now, we know that this is a sort of avaricious monster we've got, you know, the corporate greed. And what that reveals is when rights are not being protected, well, nobody's rights are safe because we don't really believe that. We don't really believe in the right to life. So that's how this all connects back together.
Okay. We've been focusing on the government. But there's also the other side of the equation, which is what the citizen or the person in the country has a right to do. And there's this other idea, well, there's a complementary idea here, isn't there, of right of necessity, which is, as I understand it, if terrible things are happening, if a government's doing a massively criminal thing, if the government constitutes a tyranny, you know, if it's engaged in the treasonous betrayal of the people, then you have a right to break the law, in inverted commas, in order to uphold your responsibilities, your duty as a citizen. So maybe you can say a little bit about that. How does that work out legally?
Yeah, so that's all absolutely right. I think sometimes talking about necessity and even right of revolution can sound a bit abstract. A simpler way of explaining it is everybody's got the basic right to self-defense. And that's the corollary of having the right to life. Right. And that's just a principle, I would say, of natural law as much as anything else. How can you ever tell a living being that it doesn't have the right to defend its own life? It's not just humans, it's animals, and it's our children or the people we love or whoever it is. That's the most inalienable principle of life, that we have the right to defend our own lives and the lives of other people around us. So, you know, that's a more simple way of explaining this principle of legal necessity.
And this is rooted in English common law, isn't it, as I understand it? Right. Again, it's not just some vague idea that someone dreamt up. It's like at the heart of English law.
The right to self-defence, of course it is. And not just English law, it's there in any legal system, because there has to be some relationship between law and morality. And so if you have a legal system that doesn't connect to that most basic principle of the right to self-defense, people aren't going to take it seriously. They're not going to respect it. So it's not just a principle of law. It's the foundational principle of law.
Right.
As soon as you move away from this idea of the divine right of kings, where the king can just kill whoever he wants just because he's, you know, having a bad day. It is the principle of legality. This idea of self-defense. Necessity then sort of broadens it out a little bit. It comes from, there's a lot of case law from the Fire of London. generally, it's not legal to break down your neighbor's door. But if you break down your neighbor's door because her house is on fire and you want to get her out, well, that's not a crime. In fact, it's almost an obligation to act, isn't it? It's obviously a wrong thing not to try and rescue your neighbour if her house is on fire.
So you've got this idea of a natural disaster and having to do what you've got to do to respond to it to save life. And at the same time, you've also got, as I understand it, a response to criminality. If criminality is happening, you have a right to intervene, to prevent a killing, prevent a destruction of people's livelihoods as a willful act by a criminal person or a criminal class.
Yes. And of course, it's very relevant, this idea, you know, right now, you know, morally and sometimes legally, where we're all being asked to take action to protect the collective, whether it's, you know, wear masks or whatever it is, you know, this understanding of the duty and the right and the corresponding obligation. So, yes, this is a foundational principle.
Yeah, and we had this, we've got an interesting case study, haven't we?
We do.
I was accused with someone else, David, my friend, of causing £7,000 of criminal damage at King's College in London, which was part of a non-violence campaign to get King's College to divest from fossil fuels, from a project of mass destruction, not least to students. And we went to court and, in our slightly amateur way, I have to say, but we argued our right and necessity, that we were acting in order to prevent harm, prevent the massively greater harm of the climate catastrophe. And the judge was having nothing of it, was he? He was like, I remember being told by some lawyers, it was a done and dusted case, we were going to lose it. And we made our case to these 16 people in the jury. And after 2 days, they were out for the minimum amount of time. And it was a unanimous verdict, and the verdict was not guilty.
Yes. So
that surprised you as well, didn't it, a little bit?
It was a really powerful moment, because you didn't have a lawyer. You were just standing up, addressing 12 men and women who'd been chosen by sortition in the
London borough, weren't they?
Just ordinary people, no bias in any direction, just hearing the account of your story and your organic farm and what had happened through that. And within, I think it was less than an hour, unanimously, they had decided that you did what you needed to do, that your actions were justified, they were necessary. That was getting outside, slipping the shackles of this system that is, you know, separating us from the most basic propositions of truth and law. And of course, this links to the idea of citizens' assemblies, because this is the bit of the system we already have. And so just looking at what that means for ordinary rebels around the country, I think it's quite common to say we're prepared to break the law because the consequences of not doing it are going to be so serious. But my perspective as a lawyer on that has been, well, that actually isn't a legally correct analysis. I understand why people describe it in that way. We know we're talking about people willing to get arrested and to make that personal sacrifice. But if what you're doing is taking action in order to safeguard the Commonwealth, in order to safeguard the state, in order to safeguard your right to life and the right to life of others, that's not a crime. To describe that as a crime is to pervert the very basis of our legal system. So yes, you have to advise people that the reality is, because, you know, we live in a society where the law enforces the status quo to some extent, probably a lot of the time, you will get arrested, you will get charged, you will get convicted. That's not the same saying on a proper legal analysis, you're breaking the law, you're not. If your intention is to save life, you're upholding the law.
Yeah, and I suppose that's sort of rooted in this idea that when you're charged with criminal damage, it's criminal damage without lawful excuse, right? Which is rooted in this idea that doing something disruptive is not in itself illegal. It's disruptive without any reasonable purpose, as you might say. And the reasonable purpose is rooted in the idea of necessity, the necessity to prevent greater harm. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of this tradition, but what, just to sum up where we're up to, as I see it, with the climate crisis and the proposition of the destruction of whole societies and whole states, which is an objective potentiality, we move this right of necessity onto a whole new level, which is what the right of revolution is saying, right? It's not like, you know, someone's going to hit someone else in a pub, so I'm going to grab hold of them. That's right of necessity. That's what tradition it sort of means. What we're dealing here is a whole death project, a whole project of criminality, which has to be stopped. And that gives you the right of necessity, the right of revolution, the right to actually bring down the government, not just politically and morally, but legally. You know, and those people that do not do that are breaking their social contract.
Yeah, exactly. So in a way, you could just think of this in pairs, and the you've got at a small level, you know, the fight in the pub or whatever, and somebody defending themselves. That's the ordinary crime and self-defense. Then you take the higher crime of treason, the threat to the existence of the state itself, then the pair for that is the right of revolution.
Right.
So crime, self-defense, treason, right of revolution.
Right.
Just simple corresponding pairs.
Yeah. Yeah. Dynamite stuff, as I said. You know, I mean, this is, it's immensely powerful. It makes me terrified and excited in equal measure. Yeah, so let's just finish off this video by moving on to the sort of positive, which is how we frame the necessity of a global uprising against the international corporate class, against this global death project, which we're witnessing in at the present time. And how does this narrative of rights, in your view, how do we construct this into a political message, if you see what I mean? Because there's different ways we can construct rights. Say something about that.
Sure. So I think the key thing here is understanding this is non-ideological. It will strike a lot of people as ideological, but it isn't. And I'm just going to go back for a minute to the UN negotiations, because I think they give us a sort of understanding of this.
Right.
You know, the reason governments haven't been able to agree a deal that would keep everybody safe is because the governments of the global north have refused any accountability for harms. We've got a law, the no harm principle. One government can't hurt the territory of another state, but to be enforced, countries have to pay compensation to each other. Now, over the years, I've had various people say to me, when I've been taking a position, well, which side are you on? You know, why are you on their side? Why are you not on our side? And it's really tempting to respond to that by saying, well, actually, I'm on the side of the people who aren't trying to destroy, you know, everything. But that's not the correct answer here. The correct answer is there isn't a side. Not, you know, utopian, not dreamy, we're all one together. Just logically, there isn't a side in the climate crisis. Either we find a way to contain it and survive, or we don't. And we're never going to make a deal collectively if the people who've caused the harm today don't account for that, don't accept responsibility for that. You just won't be able to make a deal. Therefore, the principles of equity are non-ideological principles, the only way you're actually going to get a deal. the only way you'll be able to work collectively and cooperatively. The same thing applies at the more individual level, individual rights. It's absolutely, we know people are dying now, they're being displaced now at scale. Now, according to one tradition, we're in a very progressive society, and most people, their rights are safe, and the problem is just that some people don't have their rights yet. So we want to pull them up and then everything will be good.
Yeah, and that narrative is the sort of one we've grown up with in the global north, isn't it? Is there's, you know, there's these different groups. This is the sort of Whig theory of history, as it were, isn't it? Is we're progressing up and, you know, once upon a time, hardly anyone had the rights. And then, you know, the middle class got the rights, the workers got the rights, you know, and then black people got the rights. And it's like everything's getting better. And there's these groups that need to be brought on board, as you might say. But there's another way of looking at it. In the climate crisis, what's this other way of looking at it?
So take that irony of the US Constitution. All people are equal, but then you have slavery. That isn't a situation where it's just, unfortunately, that's a bit of a problem we've got there. Just sort that one out later. What that's revealing is you've got a society where nobody's rights are really protected because nobody's actually taking that principle of we're all equal before the law seriously. What we're seeing now with the devastation of whole parts of the planet, the devastation of communities around the world, what's that's manifesting, if we really listen to it, if we understand it, is that nobody's rights are safe. That's why the Black Lives Matter movement says when Black Lives Matter, all lives will matter. If we allow that some people's lives don't matter, it means we don't take that principle seriously, and that puts everybody at risk.
Yeah.
So that is the understanding. What we're seeing now, you know, the devastation in the global south that's happening now, because the unconstrained power that corporates now have, unconstrained by governments, because it's based on more and more and more, as they exhaust some sacrifice zones, we need to make more and bigger sacrifices to the corporate gods. And so we know eventually that's going to be everything. This is a system that's going to sacrifice everything. So what the breaches of rights now are revealing in marginalized communities, in global communities, is the failure of the system as a whole.
So are you saying, like, there's a legal principle here, which is no one has rights unless everyone has rights? Right, that's a sort of legal idea, but it's also manifested in a political reality that if we don't protect the rights of those people on frontline communities in the more vulnerable areas of the world, we actually politically are sacrificing ourselves, because it's just a matter of time before we're all dead. We've yes. all been sacrificed to this monstrous, like, tyrannous project.
Yes.
So these two things support each other, is that right?
Exactly. In other words, we have, because for the moment, temporarily, we have a small number of people who are traveling on the Titanic first class, enjoying the party so much that they can't hear those people screaming in the decks below. There's the illusion that our rights are secure as we head towards the iceberg, but they're not. And so if we listen carefully, if we attend to what's going on and we notice the gross violations and abuses of people's rights around the world, what that should really tell us is nobody's rights are safe because we don't take this principle seriously. We're still living in societies where actually it is the most basic thing of might is right. That is the law. Mm. And so it's the failure to deliver on the Enlightenment project of the constraint of power through the imposition of individual rights that are universalized in a non-ideological way. This is going to be our downfall if we can't sort it out fast.
Right, and this is then, as I see it, like, and maybe I'm not quite, you know, getting the words right, but as I see it, this is the basis of a narrative for this global uprising, this non-violent upsurge rebellion against this death project, which is we're all in this together, both morally and politically, but also legally, you know, and sort of non-ideologically, as you might say, that we either have rights or we don't. And those rights have to be given to everybody or nobody. And if we're going to have them, everyone's got to get them. And everyone includes children. It includes the next generations. It includes the natural world. It includes the animal kingdom. In other words, we have a language here. Instead of everyone, you know, it's mine versus yours sort of stuff that we've had for a few decades. It's more like we've got this thing coming down the road, this monstrous proposition that we're going to destroy everything and everybody. And that creates this solidarity of purpose based upon the moral and legal conception of inalienable rights. Going back to, you know, all our traditions. I mean, there's traditions in many cultures on this, isn't there? But in, you know, our tradition, mine and yours tradition, it goes back to Prince Charles and going, no, you're not. No, you're not going to have us all die. You know, if you do that, you're breaking the contract, mate.
Yes, exactly.
That's sort of what it comes down to.
It is. And it, I think the key point here is that it is non-ideological. Of course, it is, you know, morally atrocious what is happening now, what is happening to people in particular in the sacrifice zones that we have, that the capitalism, you know, depends upon.
Yeah.
But it's not just that. It's unless we understand that that is the unravelling of the system as a whole, because our rights are so interdependent on each other, that's why it's both rights and obligations, then, you know, that is the only way we can save ourselves.
Yeah.
So it is understanding it is both moral and strategic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like everything comes together.
Yes.
I mean, it's like an absolute crisis, so an absolute necessity to find our common humanity and to find a common basis on what it is to be human. I think that's what we're trying to say as we sum up.
Yes.
I mean, I'm not quite sure we've, you know, got it all quite right in this video. But I think what we're saying is there's something enormously powerful here and enormously exciting, I think, because we have a counter narrative to the death narrative of we're all just sitting around waiting to die, which effectively is what the corporate class is telling us to do at the moment. So I just want to finish off, well, I want to thank you, Tim, for enlightening us, and to say, yeah, talk is cheap. That's what I want to say, you know. Like, these are great, and it's totally necessary we get our ducks in a row in terms of saying, no, we're not doing illegal stuff. No, we have got a right to bring down governments if they're going to, you know, continue on this path. And what needs to happen is we need to go to the streets and make that real. Otherwise, we're not going to be here much longer.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's not allowing Rebel for Life to be commodified into a slogan. It's understanding Rebel for Life is deeply rooted in natural law, in our political systems, that it is an obligation that not just we have, but all animals have. You fight for your life if you've got any self-respect and any dignity.
Yeah, I can't add to that. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. So much. Great talking to you.